Okay, so let's begin at the beginning then with this question of what is professionalism? And I want to look at a few points with you now around this whole idea of professionalism, and in particular to relate it to the idea of managerialism. What we've seen in terms of managerialism and professionalism is, over the years, a new relationship developing between local and central government. So the traditional approach was that central government, as the name implied, dealt with matters that affected the whole country. You know, that central government would cover the whole of the UK, basically. So for matters that applied across the whole of the country, that's a concern of central government. And for matters on a local basis, that's a matter for local government, for local councils, whether county councils, district councils, unitary authorities, or whatever. But that was the traditional model. Central government focuses on national issues across the UK. Local government focuses on its specific areas, you know, that specific county or borough or whatever. But what we've seen over the years, in the last, say, 20 or so years, is a shift in that. So that what we've seen dating back to the time of Margaret Thatcher, for example, is much more central control of what happens at a local level. So there's a lot of things that happen now that are at the local authority level, which were previously more or less entirely within the hands of the local authority, and central government didn't get involved. But over the years, we've seen greater and greater involvement of central government in local government matters. And part of that has been a business model of public service. And what I mean by a business model is trying to make public services as much like businesses as possible. And again, this dates back to the days of Margaret Thatcher. Because Margaret Thatcher had this view that businesses are, by their very nature, motivating places, that because they have the profit motive, then people within the business sector are motivated to do well, to be efficient and not waste resources, because that will increase their profit. And the business would then be a safer business in terms of not going out of business. It would be a more successful business. And that was deemed to be in everybody's interest within that business. But she also thought that because public services don't have a profit motive, therefore there's little or nothing to motivate people to do well in public service, to not be wasteful, to be efficient and effective in what we do in public services. Now, those two ideas have since been heavily criticised, because if you think about it, they are both fundamentally flawed. The idea, for example, that businesses are, by their very nature, efficient and not wasteful, just doesn't fit with reality. That if you think about your own experiences of dealing with shops and companies and so on, would you get the impression that they're all ultra-efficient because the more efficient they are, the more money they'll be? Or is it that so many businesses are not particularly well organised, not particularly effective at what they do? So can you see how it was a fairly fundamental flaw in Margaret Thatcher's thinking that somehow the profit motive will itself make businesses efficient? That just doesn't fit reality. It just doesn't hold water as an argument. But the other argument is flawed as well. The idea that because there's no profit motive in public services, that there's no motivation, that people won't do their best, won't be efficient and not waste resources, is also a flawed assumption. Because, I mean, how many people come into public service because they want to make money, you know, that they want to profit. Of course, people want to be paid an adequate salary for their efforts. But isn't it a primary motivation in public services that people want to do good, that people want to be public servants? Now, can you imagine nurses only going into nursing because of the money, that they've got no interest in caring for sick people, that they're not motivated by public service, they're just motivated by financial matters? So what we ended up with then is, because of this very faulty logic, was the development of an approach to public services that basically involves trying to fit the square peg of public services into the round hole of a business model. So what Margaret Thatcher and her government and subsequent governments did was to privatise as much of public service as they could. So there are now things that are private businesses which, before Margaret Thatcher and her ideology that was anti-public service, before she came along, those were part of what we would perhaps call the welfare state. So can you see how there's been this movement towards privatising a lot of what were previously public services? And then what was left as public service was then made as business-like as possible. So that for some years now, social services, the health service, schools and so on, have been using the language of business. They've been talking about business plans and things like that. Whereas in reality, they're not a business, they're a public service. So that has caused significant difficulties, as you can imagine. And I'll say more about that in a little while. Now, part of that business mentality was the idea of targets and performance indicators, because that's how businesses are expected to work. And I say are expected because many of them don't work in that way. But businesses are expected to work in the way of having targets to aim for example, profit targets. How much profit are they going to make by when? How are they going to make that profit? Well, you would then have performance indicators in terms of, you know, number of sales. How do you increase the number of sales? How do you increase the number of add-on sales? You know, so if somebody buys a product, how do you sell them another product to go with it? Things like that. They would have performance indicators in terms of, you know, what is the number of returns of products that have been sold. How do you keep that to a minimum of people bringing stuff back and asking for a refund? So do you see how the idea of targets and performance indicators comes from the world of business? It comes from the world of selling goods and services, not from the world of public service. So what we've had is many years of difficulties as a result of this. Now, in 1997, when the new Labour government came into power, there was widespread expectation that, because the Labour Party has traditionally valued public service and the Conservative Party had not, it was widely expected that we would see a turn of the tide and that we would go back to valuing public services and treating them as public services, not as pseudo-businesses. But that was wrong. History has taught us that that was a false expectation, because what New Labour introduced was what they called the modernisation agenda for public services. And that modernisation agenda turned out to be very, very similar to what the previous Conservative governments had been doing in terms of trying to make public services as business-like as possible. So the terminology changed, but the ideology didn't, that it continued to be a focus on public services as a form of business in a sense. There's been a movement away from seeing public services as an entity in their own right, in a sense, to seeing them as an extension of business. And I would argue that that's created a lot of problems over the the years. And in particular, I'd want to emphasise the impact on morale, the negative effect of this emphasis on making public services as businesslike as possible. Because you see, that's where we get this term managerialism. Do you see how it's the idea that the services are managed like a business would be managed? That's the idea of managerialism. And one of the effects of this is to make everything top down. Because the idea of being a professional is that the professionals make the decision based on their knowledge, their skills and their values, stuff we'll look at a bit later. They base their decisions on their knowledge, skills and values and so on. Whereas if you've got this sort of business model, do you see how if it's based on targets and indicators, then it's all top down, in the sense that central government tells local government what its targets must be. And then councillors at local government level have to make sure that senior managers are hitting those targets. The senior managers have to make sure that middle managers are hitting those targets. Middle managers have to make sure that junior managers are hitting those targets. Junior managers have to make sure that staff are hitting those targets. So do you see how the whole thing is top down? And one thing we've known for a long, long time is where people are not given a degree of autonomy in their work, where they're told what to do, then it's very difficult to get job satisfaction. And if you're not getting job satisfaction, that tends to have an effect on morale. So what we have seen over the years is a lowering of morale. And we'll look at this in another session in more detail. But it's important to recognise for now that it's no coincidence that so many workplaces in the public sector these days are characterised by low morale. It's a reflection of, if you like, the managerialism and the deprofessionalisation, the way there has been an emphasis on central government deciding what should happen rather than the people at the coalface, as it were, the people who are actually engaged with communities making decisions about how best to respond to the problems they encounter. So that's had an impact on morale, but it's also had an impact on professionalism, in the sense that it has tended to undermine the sense of professional identity that people have. If people are told, this is what you must do, these are the targets you must hit, these are the performance indicators that must be met, then can you see how that would then undermine the sense of autonomy, the sense of professionalism? It undermines the sense of trust, because one of the key issues around professionalism is trust. It means professionals are trusted to do their best, even in difficult circumstances. They're trusted to abide by a set of values and so on. Issues we'll come back to in a little while. So can you see how we've had this history of government after government after government not valuing public service and presenting it as if it is like a sort of a second-class citizen version of the business world? And that's had a significant impact on morale and on professionalism. And so there have been lots of complaints over the years of staff in public services, social work, social care and other public services, having to focus on things like filling in forms and hitting targets and perhaps losing sight of what the job is really all about. As some people say, the emphasis has been on paperwork, not people work. Yeah, so losing that emphasis on people. Now, what we've seen in terms of the coalition government more recently is talk about the big society. Now, do you see how that's taking the idea of public services again in a different direction, that's different from the traditional one where public services are valued? So the idea that so much of what is currently provided by professionals within public services can be provided informally by the community has been criticised for being both naive, of not recognising the extent of the importance of the work that's done in public service, and also again undervaluing public service, not seeing the importance of having proper public services properly funded and so on. So what we're now facing then is a situation where we need to explore options for responding to that. And at one extreme, one option we've got is that we can become dejected, we can feel unloved and unvalued, and we can become negative and cynical and defeatist, and we can sit around moaning about how dreadful it is these days and that we're not getting proper support and funding and so on. Or we can reaffirm our professionalism. We can do everything we reasonably can to show the value of what we do, not only in social work and social care, but in public services more broadly. So can you see how historically we're at a key time in our history at the moment? What happens now is going to be quite significant in terms of the direction we go in, as to whether we are successful in reaffirming professionalism or whether it's eroded further and we, in a sense, lose what's left of our sense of identity. Now, one of the things we'll look at in another session is around burnout as a response to stress. Now, full-blown burnout is quite significant. You know, it's very noticeable if you come across somebody who is fully burnt out. But there's also what I like to call a condition of being semi-burnt out, which is very, very common. And what you get is people who haven't completely thrown the towel in, but they're like only functioning at half their capability, in a sense. You know, they're just like ticking over. There's a lot of what I would call minimalism. You know, it's just about, oh, why bother? You know, just do what you need to. Don't get yourself into trouble and so on. And you see how having public services that are based on people functioning like that is seriously bad news, in a sense. And bearing in mind what we said about confidentiality, am I right in thinking that many of you, most of you, possibly even all of you, have come across examples of that, where you don't have to name names, obviously, but where you've come across people where you think their heart's not really in it. Yeah, they're just sort of chugging along, as it were. And sometimes it's whole teams, you know, where they're just, the morale is rock bottom, people's heart is not in it. They're very negative, they're very dismissive of all sorts of things. So that's part of the danger of this, and I think it fits with what you're saying. They have, in a sense, abandoned their values. And they become, like I said earlier, they become culture victims, really. You know, that they're just doing what everybody else does. If everyone else sits around moaning, they sit around moaning. And when people like me come along and say, well, if you're not happy, what are you going to do about it? Can you see how very often that doesn't go down too well when I ask people that question? Well, if as professionals you're not happy, shouldn't you be doing something about it? So that is clearly part of professionalism. Okay, anything else before we move on, folks? No. Okay, let's look at a few more issues then around professionalism. What's emerged in recent years is what a lot of people, and myself included, are calling the new professionalism. And what that's about is recognising the importance of reaffirming professionalism, of not allowing our professionalism to be eaten away even more. And as part of that, we need to be clear about what professionalism is, and also understand how our understanding of professionalism has changed over time. So let's start by looking at what stayed the same in terms of professionalism, what are the constants, if you like, and then we'll move on to look at how some things about professionalism have changed. So what has remained constant? Well, one thing is the idea of a professional knowledge base. That professionals, by definition, have a knowledge base to draw on. So, for example, if you went to see your doctor because you weren't well, and the doctor said, well, sorry, but I don't know anything about the human body or disease processes or whatever, do you see how you would probably think you were dreaming, wouldn't you? Or that somebody put something in your coffee. That it just doesn't fit with our expectations. We expect professionals to have a knowledge base. If you needed to go and see a solicitor, you'd expect that solicitor to have a knowledge of the law. Is that a fair comment? Yeah. So can you see how that applies to us as well? As professionals, we're expected to have a knowledge base and to use that knowledge base in practice. But you see how a lot of the negativity, the cynicism, the semi-burnout, the low morale culture that we've been talking about can often mean that people are not using their professional knowledge base. They're just doing what other people around them do. They are not using their knowledge base. So a report, for example, may not contain an analysis based on professional knowledge, but may be just copied and pasted from another report for someone else in similar circumstances. So we have to hold on to and value our professional knowledge base. There's also a professional skills base. You know, that what we do as professionals is, by and large, highly skilled. Some of it's simple and straightforward, but you get that in any job. But a lot of what we do is actually highly skilled work. But you see how, again, if there's no sense of professional pride there's no sense of what we do is important, that it's just getting through the day in this very bureaucratic, managerialist culture, then people won't be using their skills to the full. So that's something to bear in mind as well. There's also a professional value base, our ethics, if you like. So part of the expectation of being a professional is that you subscribe to a certain value base. And that's part of what gives professionals the level of trust. Can you see how values bring about trust? You know, if people know part of being a nurse, for example, is a commitment to caring for people, then that's part of a nursing value base. Then that's going to help to get people to trust nurses. And that applies for any professional group, that your value base is part of trust. But it's also part of our motivation. Because if you think about it, isn't it our values that brought us into this type of work in the first place? Isn't it our values that motivate us to do what we do or what we want to do in the future? So to lose sight of our values is dangerous stuff. We also have to recognise the significance of professional accountability. And by accountability, what I mean is that professionals are expected, with guidance, in consultation where appropriate, but basically, professionals are expected to make decisions. It's not just a case of doing what your boss tells you. That's not the hallmark of a professional job. So the idea is that professionals make their own decisions, therefore have to be accountable for those decisions. And the playing down of professionalism over the years can put us in a difficult situation. Do you see, if somebody's become a culture victim, for example, you know, if they're just doing what everybody else does, they've abandoned their professionalism, their professional values, and something goes wrong. And they are involved in, say, an inquiry or an investigation or even a court case. Let's imagine you've got somebody who is being cross-examined by a barrister because something has gone wrong, something's gone pear-shaped. And then they've been asked, why did you make that decision? And all they can say is, well, that's what we do in our team. That's the way we deal with these matters. Do you see how they would be expected, wouldn't they, to come up with a professional rationale? I did it because of what I know about this and what I know about that. I did it because, and that because then leads into a professional explanation. Because that's what an account is, an explanation. Give an account of means describe or explain. So accountability means you can be called upon to explain your actions. Why did you do that? And if you can't give a professional reason, the only reason you can give is, well, it's habit, that's what we do. Or it seemed like a good idea at the time. Do you see how in accountability terms, you're on very thin ice? You're going to have significant difficulties there. So part of professionalism is the idea of accountability. But don't confuse accountability with blame. Okay, because blame is often something that people attach to one or more people when something goes wrong, whether it's justified or not. Now, in these terms, it's important that we're clear about the difference between a good decision and the right decision. Okay, so good decision versus right decision. A good decision is one that's been arrived at through a proper process of professional assessment and professional decision making. Whereas the right answer could arise just by pure luck. Imagine, for example, in a residential childcare setting. Imagine a new member of staff still hasn't found their feet yet, and they want to take one of the young people on a one-to-one outing, but they're not sure whether it's safe because they don't know enough about that young person yet. They don't know enough about how things work. So they say to their boss, I want to take this young person out on a one-to-one outing. Do you think that's okay? And imagine their boss takes a coin out of their pocket, tosses that coin, and then says, yeah, fine, it's safe. Take this young person out on a one-to-one outing. And then that's what happens. The member of staff and the young person go out on a one-to-one outing, and it's fine. No problems. It's an enjoyable, enriching experience for the young person. So it's all been good. So do you see how that was the right decision? That it was safe for this young person to go out on a one-to-one outing with that member of staff. Do you think it was a good decision, though? What do you think? No, clearly wasn't, was it, a good decision, even though it turned out to be the right one? Because what would have happened, do you think, if, let's say this was an evening outing, and on that evening, the inspectors arrived for an unannounced inspection. And they said, right, where are all the children and young people? And the staff say, oh, these children are there, and that young person's here, and, oh, there's one young person gone on an outing with a member of staff. Okay. And then the inspectors say, can I see the risk assessment that was done before this member of staff, this inexperienced member of staff, took a young person out on a one-to-one? And the manager says, well, we didn't do a risk assessment, I just tossed a coin. What do you think the inspectors might think of that? Do you think they'd think it was acceptable? But it was the right decision. Exactly. That's the point. It's not about the right decision, it's about a good decision, because you can't control all the variables. It could well have been that it was the other way around. It could have been that the manager did a thorough risk assessment and decided it was safe for that young person to go out on the outing, and it all went sadly wrong because of factors that were unanticipated or that were beyond their control. Do you see what I'm getting at? So it could have been a good decision in the sense that it was done properly, but it wasn't the right decision. So do you see how being a professional is not about getting the right decision? Because no one can guarantee getting the right decision. But what you can guarantee is a good decision. Can you see the subtle but significant difference there? That what it's about is a good decision. And a good decision will be one that's been done on the basis of our professional knowledge, skills and values. One that's carefully thought through, not that's just down to copying other people, habit, just making a decision on the spur of the moment with nothing to back it up, which is, of course, far from professional. So professional accountability isn't about blame. It's about, can you provide a proper account of why you took a certain decision or not? And I don't know about you, but I think that's perfectly reasonable to expect professionals to be able to do that. Now, what's also important about professionalism is professional development. And what I mean by that is professionals are expected to get better over time. In a non-professional job, as long as you're basically competent, nobody's going to mind much. For example, I don't know who cleans this room and how long they've been cleaning it for. But let's say the person who cleans the room has been cleaning it for 5 years. And when they first started, they did a basically competent job. And they now do a basically competent job 5 years later, but they're no better at it than they were then. Do you see, in a non-professional job, that's acceptable, isn't it? Yeah, as long as it's a basically sound job, the fact that they're no better at it doesn't matter, as long as it's basically sound. But what about, say, a professional job like a teacher? If you're a parent, or if you're not a parent, imagine being a parent and thinking about a teacher who's had 5 years' experience of teaching, and they're no better at teaching after 5 years than they were after 5 days. Would you think that's acceptable for a teacher to be teaching children, to be in charge of their education in a sense, when they're no better after 5 years than they were after 5 days? What do you think? No. Clearly it's not acceptable, is it? Part of the idea of being a professional is you get better. You learn from experience. You build on that. And so you build up your knowledge and your skills and your values and your confidence and your credibility and so on. So you get better over time. So that's why part of professional registration, for example, is the idea of CPD, of continuous professional development. You have to show evidence that you're not just coasting in neutral, that you are actually learning, so that after a year, you're better than you were to begin with. After 2 years, you're much better. After 3 years, you're cooking on gas. Yeah, you know, you're doing really well. That's the expectation of professionals. That's why there's such an emphasis on professional development, continuing to learn, continuing to read, for example, and stuff like that. Now, what's also significant about being a professional is what I would call professional body. And by that, I don't mean an organisation, you know, like the British Association of Social Workers, the Social Care Association, or whatever, you know, might be the equivalent in other professional groups. When I talk about a professional body, what I mean is a sense of being part of something bigger than yourself. Do you see what I'm getting at? It's very easy, for example, for busy practitioners to focus on their workload, their desk, if you like, their current pressures, and lose sight of the big picture. To not have any sense of being part of something bigger than themselves in terms of being part of a profession. So, for example, it's likely that nurses, say, will not be concerned with just this patient and that patient and all the other patients they have to look after, but also feeling part of the nursing profession, which collectively is playing an important part in the healthcare of our country. So do you see how part of being a professional should be having this like professional identity, having a sense of being something bigger, part of something bigger than ourselves, that's actually making a difference. And often that doesn't happen, unfortunately. In fact, I would go so far as to say that this is a significant problem for British social work, in the sense that we have a far weaker sense of professional identity than social work groups in other countries. I've been fortunate that I've had the opportunity to work with social work colleagues in other countries like Australia, Canada, the United States, India, and Latvia, and one or two other places as well. Ireland, for example. And for the most part, social workers in other countries tend to have a much stronger sense of being part of something bigger than just their caseload, their desk, their computer, and so on. But also, if you compare social workers in this country with other professionals, is it not fair to say that other professionals, you know, like nurses, occupational therapists, and so on, often have a much stronger sense of professional identity than we do? A professional association and a union are two different things. So that a union is about protecting employment rights and stuff like that, whereas a professional association is about promoting your profession. And although they overlap to a certain extent, they're fundamentally different things. And that is the issue that a trade union, for example, may be an excellent trade union, but it's not a professional association. It's not there to promote your profession. It's there to safeguard your employment rights, basically, and related matters. So do you see the subtle but significant difference there? And if you compare, say, with the National Association of Social Workers in the United States, last I heard they had 600,000 members. Now, obviously, the United States is a lot bigger than the UK, but if you do the maths, if you compare the the relative populations of the two countries, you can see that even for a country the size of the United States, 600,000 members is a high proportion of the people who are eligible to join that organisation. So do you see the picture I'm trying to paint, in a sense, is that it's something, and we'll touch on this in terms of history in a minute, it's something that historically has developed this legacy for us, which is actually quite problematic in the sense that what we have now is a relatively low level of a sense of professional pride, identity and strength compared with A, social workers in other countries, and B, other professionals within this country. So that's the, in terms of what is professionalism, you know, these items that we've looked at, these issues, should help to paint that picture for you. But one thing we need to recognise is that part of that as well is this sort of collective identity, in a sense, which historically has been quite weak. Now, why is that? That's what we're going to look at now. So I've given you an overview of the current situation in terms of professionalism. These are things that have always been the case with professionalism and will no doubt continue. But what's changed over the years? Well, let's start off by looking at traditional professionalism. If you go back to, say, the 1960s, for example, then we had what I would call traditional professionalism. And that was characterised by, for example, the idea that we know best. You still get elements of this today in, say, the medical profession. Although, to be fair to the medical profession, you know, they have made significant strides forward. But, you know, have you ever had the experience, for example, of going to your doctor when you have been coughing and spluttering and you say, "Doctor, I think I've got a chest infection." And the doctor will then say, "And which medical school did you train at?" Do you see how it's not intended, according to the traditional model, that people understand their own problems? That's why you go to a professional who knows best. Now, there are people still practicing in social work today who can remember the days when, for example, hospital social workers wore white coats, yeah, and were seen as almost like doctor's assistants, in a sense. So do you see how that fitted in with the traditional we know best model of professionalism? It was elitist in the sense of there's seen as a hierarchy between professionals and their clientele, you know, with the clientele being on a lower rung, as it were, and the professionals on a higher rung. And it was non-participatory. What I mean by that is you don't get a voice. Yeah? If the doctor says, take these tablets, then the expectation is you take these tablets, and it's, you're not part of safeguarding and promoting your own health in a sense. Now, traditionally, that's how social work worked. If you go back to the 50s and 60s, where there were what were defined as problem families, maladjusted individuals, dysfunctional families, you know, these sort of what today we would regard as judgmental terms were widely used in the 50s and 60s in terms of, here are families that are struggling to cope with life's challenges, so they need professionals to sort things out for them. Now, what we then got was that traditional model of professionalism being heavily challenged by the radical social work movement, which began in the late 60s but didn't really get going until well into the 1970s. And to my mind, radical social work has proven to be a mixed blessing. So our emphasis these days on discrimination and oppression, for example, has its roots in radical social work, if you'll pardon the pun. So that a more sociological and political understanding of people's problems, we owe that mainly to the radical social work movement in our history. But it wasn't all good news. So, for example, one of the things that radical social work also brought was a rejection of professionalism. And what radical social work brought was what came to be known as anti-professionalism. So in the heyday of radical social work, from the sort of the 70s through the 80s and into the 90s, what was associated strongly with radical social work was a rejection of professionalism. Professionalism was seen as a bad thing. It was seen as elitist, as distancing ourselves from the people that we should be working closely with, of having this sort of we know best mentality, which is, you know, clearly not consistent with what we would now regard as social work values. So that was what happened in terms of radical social work. Now, for me, that was a mistake, because what we should have been doing was rejecting elitism, not rejecting professionalism. So can you see how what we did, in effect, was basically to throw the baby out with the bathwater? Here is a form of professionalism that has all the stuff we talked about before: knowledge, skills, values, accountability, professional development, sense of being collective identity as professionals, and so on, plus all the stuff about elitism, we know best, it's non-participatory. And what was rejected was not the elitism stuff, but the whole thing about professionalism is seen as a bad thing. So do you see how we then lost out because of that? So for a long time, professionalism was seen as a bad thing. It was seen as something to be wary of, because it was automatically associated with elitism and, in a sense, the misuse of power. But I would argue that it doesn't have to be that way, that you can have forms of professionalism that are not elitist. And that's what's meant, basically, by the new professionalism, you know, as the heading tells us, in a sense. And what the new professionalism is about, really, is recognising that it doesn't have to be we know best. It can be about bringing expertise together. So you work with people who have knowledge and understanding for themselves, but then we have knowledge and understanding too, and the idea is we work in partnership. we bring that expertise together rather than assume that the person we are trying to help is just there to be passively told what to do because they've got no expertise. If you think about it, isn't that the direction that health and health service are now moving in terms of trying to get more patient participation, for example, emphasising the taking responsibility for your own health as far as possible, rather than just getting on with your life and going to the doctor when things go wrong. So there can be that movement towards bringing expertise together. And I don't mind saying that at the moment I've got a really good GP who is excellent at this sort of thing. So on the odd occasion I go to see him about something, he will involve me in the process rather than, you know, the traditional thing of somebody's written a prescription before you've even finished explaining what you're trying to say because they know best. So do you see how if the medical profession can move in that direction without abandoning professionalism, why can't we? Why can't we have the strengths of professionalism without the elitism? And also it can be egalitarian rather than elitist. So we can work with people as far as possible on an equal footing. And that's the idea of partnership. You know, you're probably familiar with the idea of partnership as a social work value. We don't go in and tell people what to do. We work with people to try and help them move forward. And so that's the idea of partnership. So its idea is it's as egalitarian as far as possible rather than this elitist, we are somehow above you. It's about we work with you to address problems and concerns. And then instead of being non-participatory, it can be the new professionalism can be inclusive. We include people in the process. In some places, for example, now, record keeping is done with the service user. Yeah? So that in some projects, some teams, what they'll do is say a social worker does a home visit, rather than go back to the office and record that, they'll do the recording with, you know, the family or whatever and say, right, let's sum up. I think this is what we've looked at and this is what we've agreed. Are you happy with that? And it's recorded there and then. So do you see how it's not a recording about a family, for example, but with a family. That's part of the new professionalism. Again, we don't have to abandon professionalism. We can abandon elitism but still hold on to the strengths of professionalism. Just give you a parallel example there. Recently, I was running a course when somebody on the course was talking about doing an assessment on a family. And I said, hang on, let's pause for a minute and just think about that terminology. You talk about doing an assessment on a family. Is that the appropriate terminology? What do you think? Do you do an assessment on a family? With a family, exactly. Do you see what I mean? Do you see how the idea of doing an assessment on a family is the traditional elitist idea, you have nothing to offer, I have everything to offer, I come to you and I decide, I make an assessment of you, rather than we work in partnership in this egalitarian way to identify problems and potential solutions, to identify strengths to build on, and so on. Yeah? So the idea is that assessment is a joint partnership-based process, not something a professional does to somebody. And it was interesting that, you know, once I said that, the person who'd made the comment said he'd never thought about that before, about the implications of that terminology. And he was wondering whether using that terminology was actually affecting his thinking about how he did that work around assessment. Okay, so as you can see, my basic argument there is I'm fully behind radical social work in terms of a sociological and a political emphasis on discrimination and oppression and the impact of such matters on people's lives. I have no problem with that whatsoever. I'm also behind radical social work in the idea that traditional professionalism was problematic. But where I differ from what radical social work came up with is that radical social work, by and large, took the route of rejecting professionalism rather than rejecting elitism. So I think because of what's happened since radical social work in terms of, as I said before, government after government after government, devaluing public services and deprofessionalising, lowering morale and so on, then I think it's high time that we focused on reaffirming our professionalism individually and collectively. There's that phrase again. So that's important. I'm going to sort of throw it open for discussion and contribution shortly, but before I do, I just want to say, what price do we pay if we don't have professionalism? You know, what are we losing out on, in a sense, if we don't have professionalism? So let's ask that question. If we don't reaffirm professionalism, how do we lose out? What price do we pay? Well, a number of ways. First of all, it's confidence. And I don't know if you're familiar with this distinction between subjective and objective confidence. But in a nutshell, what it's about is that subjective confidence is the confidence you have in yourself. Because if you think about it, the word confidence comes from the word for trust. Yeah, so if you say, I am confident I can do something, you're saying you trust yourself to be able to do it. Confidential has the same root. You know, that confidential information is information you are trusted with. So subjective confidence is about how much do you trust yourself to be able to do whatever it is. It's about how much faith have you got in yourself. Objective confidence is how much faith have other people got in you. In other words, your credibility. And for me, that is crucial, because I think a key part of social work is being able to influence other people. And if we have no credibility, if we have no objective confidence, then we're going to really, really struggle to influence other people. Whether that's influence families, influence other professionals, influence courts, influence budget holders, whatever it is we're trying to do in terms of influencing people, we're going to really struggle if people have got no confidence in us. Is that a fair comment? Yeah? Now then, the thing to recognise is that subjective and objective confidence are interlinked. In the sense that if you don't have confidence in yourself, how can you possibly expect anybody else to have confidence in you? Do you see how that works? If you are giving off vibes that you are not confident, then people will not have faith in you and you will then struggle to influence them and the situation in a positive direction. And if you struggle to influence them, then you're going to struggle to feel confident that you are capable of doing what you're trying to do. Can you see how that works? It can become a vicious circle if you're not careful. If you have little confidence in yourself, other people won't have confidence in you. And if they don't have confidence in you, that makes your job a lot harder, which can then undermine your confidence. So professionalism is important as a foundation for confidence. That we have confidence in the value of what we are doing, for example. There'll also be problems of accountability if we don't reaffirm professionalism. If people are just doing what everybody else in the team does, do you see how they could get into difficulties if something goes wrong? If the nasty brown stuff hits the fan, for example, can you see how being called upon to account for your actions and you've got no professional analysis to offer, all you can say is, that's what we do in our team, or, well, I just thought it was a good idea at the time. Didn't really think about it, I just did it. Can you see how those sort of explanations are not professional explanations? Or saying, well, my boss suggested I do it. Can you see how that's not going to go down well if anything goes wrong? We can also have problems in terms of low morale that can lead to stress and workload management issues. We'll look at this in another session, but basically what can easily happen is if people are struggling to get the job done because of the lack of professional identity and pride and confidence and so on, then we can get stressed. And if we get stressed, we can then really struggle to get the job done. And if we really struggle to get the job done, we can then get stressed. Can you see how that works? So our workload can become unmanageable because we are struggling to get through. We are getting stressed, and the more stressful we get, the more stressed we get, the more difficult we find our job. The more difficult we find our job, the less effective we are. The less effective we are, the more pressurized we feel. So the more stress we can experience. Getting the job done becomes harder where there is low morale, where there is a lack of motivation, where people are semi-burnt out in a sense. Then there will be barriers to learning and development. I'm sure you can see that if people are, to use that phrase, welfare bureaucrats, if they see their job as filling in forms and just rationing scarce resources, which is sadly what a lot of semi-burnt out people these days see their job as, then do you see how they're not going to learn anything? Learning is off the agenda if it's just a case of going round, filling in forms and doing bureaucratic stuff. There's no use of our professional knowledge base. There's no development of our skills. There's no creativity and innovation and stuff like that. So learning and development can go out the window if we don't reaffirm professionalism. And then, of course, last but not least, what we can have is poor practice and poor outcomes. If people are not firing on all cylinders because they've drifted away from professionalism into this unstimulating, unrewarding, bureaucratic approach to the work, and there's no sense of being part of something very important, then you don't need me to tell you that that's going to be quite significant in terms of producing poor practice and poor outcomes. Okay, so just to sum up very briefly, what I've been trying to say in this session is that there are certain themes around professionalism that have been around and will no doubt continue to be around, things like knowledge, skills, values, accountability, professional development and so on. But what we've also seen is historically some significant changes, moving away originally from what was a very elitist, traditional model of professionalism in social work, through a period of anti-professionalism, where we lost our sense of shared identity, in a sense, and we're now at a stage in our evolution, if you like, a stage in our history where there are now strong efforts being made to reaffirm professionalism and put it back on the agenda.